Proposed responses to climate change range from the simple and easy to the complex and far-reaching. As these efforts get underway, it's important to go in with our eyes open to avoid doing harm in our quest to do good. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, produced with USAID's Office of Conflict Management and Mitigation, we interview experts about backdraft, the unintended peace and conflict consequences of climate change responses. I'm Sean Peoples, and today I'm speaking to Stacey Vandeveer, Professor of Global Environmental Politics and Resource Governance at the University of Massachusetts Boston, about the new energy economy and what decarbonization might mean for petrostates. Stacey, thanks so much for spending the time with me here today. I wanted to dive right in and get a sense from you what you're working on now.
I'm working on some of these intersecting issues of coal politics, of mining governance, and all the environmental, human rights, and labor issues around mining. And I'm very interested in sort of, you know, what happens to the petrostates, what happens to the oil states. So prices have been low lately, and if in fact we can really move toward decarbonization and start reducing the amount of oil being used in the world over the next few years, then, you know, what happens to Russia, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, all these kinds of things.
What brought you to this energy sector?
Yeah, so like a lot of people who worked on climate politics and policy, I was, I first came to this just trying to figure out what kind of institutions would work to get countries and people and firms and cities to cooperate to do something about climate change, to reduce emissions, to begin to adapt, to begin to like grapple with this huge problem and grappling with it, whether it's on a university campus or a global summit or whatever. And so now that policy is starting to get a little, energy policy and climate policy are starting to get a little more serious, then, you know, I've really gotten interested in, you know, the kind of, okay, so now what question, right? So there are several kind of now whats, right? So one of the ones that is sort of along the lines of this sort of backdraft concept is that, we have a huge push for much cleaner energy, which is great. And of course, I am completely supportive of. But, clean energy uses a lot of metal. It uses rare earths to build big wind turbines, right? And all that stuff still has to get mined. It still happens where people may or may not have labor rights. It still happens where people may or may not live in very poor villages on the edge of a giant, very toxic mine, right? And that doesn't change just because the windmills look pretty and are cleaner wherever they get installed, if the whole kind of economy that's behind them hasn't very changed very much. So one of my sort of phrases about this, like the old 60s phrase, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Well, this is kind of like, you know, meet the new economy, same as the old economy, right? So if we just graft this new stuff right on top of the old. So I'm interested in that whole sort of mining chain of and all the social issues around it. And similarly, a lot of people still work in the coal industry, right? There are still a lot of miners. There are still a lot of people in transport. A huge number of very poor people in the world are still hoping to get their first regular electricity hookup. And a lot of those people in India or parts of Africa are in areas that are sitting on top of a lot of coal. So if the cheapest thing to do is to dig a big hole in the ground and pull out the coal and turn on the power plant, then we should expect that's what they are going to do because that's what they need to do. Having electricity is way better than not having it, right? So for me, I'm really interested in the kind of politics of coal because in some parts of the world, coal is in decline, but some parts of the world, it's still racing forward. And unless we have like a reality-based conversation, it's not just enough to finger wave at India or China or South Africa and say, you know, you really shouldn't be burning any coal anymore. We've been burning it for 300 years, but you, on the other hand, you only got 20 and now the time is up.
What's the best way to have the start of a reality-based conversation?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to acknowledge that while we have one global climate change conversation, when people are actually dealing with energy issues, who has it, who doesn't have it, how much it costs, those decisions are much more local and much more national, right? So coal might be in decline in the US and in much of Europe. Not nearly as fast as some people sometimes suggest, but nonetheless, it's in decline, right? But that the data on where India is going and where South Africa is likely to go, those are just, they're different. It's a different world. It's a different economy. So we have to start acknowledging that these arrows are going in different directions in different parts of the world. And then rather than just say, well, the only way to understand coal is because it's a climate change bad, right? That's not the only way to understand coal. And so it's for people who don't have electricity or who need it to be cheap, that's not their primary concern. And so I think the other thing is to meet on energy, any energy question, just as coal is just an example, you have to meet people, nations, cities, wherever they are, and they need the energy.
And so maybe some of that too gets to kind of your definition of what backdraft is.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are a couple of definitions of backdraft, right? One is that as climate policy and energy policy, energy transition policy really gets serious, hundreds of billions and then trillions, like with a T, trillions, it's just an amazing number, right? Trillions of dollars are going to come into this space, right? So partly is if we know that with policies that are driving trillions of dollars in investment and building power plants or infrastructures that are going to be around for 50 or 60 years, we know that you could do a whole bunch of things that are bad for people or bad for communities and still believe you've done a great thing for the climate. So one, you know, trajectory, right, of backdraft is that, okay, climate change has arrived. We're making real policy that matters in the world. And just like any other policy arena, you can decide to do things that are really good on one level of logic, like really good climate logic, and they might be bad humanitarian logic or bad development logic, right? So I think that's one area of backdraft. And then I think the other for me is this question of how energy fits into the economy as a whole, the sort of, you know, the new economy and old economy one. The high-tech economy is not that different at the mining end of the stream than the old one.
Looking at some of these negative consequences, mm-hmm. where we're not thinking through all this, the new economy, same as the old economy, mm-hmm. play it forward. What are we doing by not taking these unintended consequences and these things where we're not really recognizing that if concerted effort needs to be?
One thing that you can't accomplish if we don't think about the other sort of parts or of the commodity stream or of the global economy as a whole is you can't actually reduce carbon emissions nearly as much as we say if the only place we're looking is at the end of the energy generation, right? So if the mining industry and the manufacturing industries are all as giant and inefficient and waste as many resources and ship things as far around the world as they do now, then 50, 60, 80% reductions in carbon emissions are not really possible. The math doesn't add up. So I think that, so if you don't address bigger parts of the economy, you miss, you miss kind of fundamentals of addressing the climate change problem. The other side is the conflict side, doing things for good reasons, whether they're environmental or social or whatever, if what they do is put more stress on already stressed communities, if what they do is add hardship in places in the world where the state is already weak or where people already live marginally, then you have perfectly happy justifications on the environmental side and you're creating hardship, maybe for many millions of people if you don't get it right.
What's the frame for having these more complex discussions, meeting people where they're at? Is mm-hmm. there a way to frame that? Because it, like you're saying, it's contextual. Mm-hmm. It can't be cookie cutter. It's happening and for different reasons all over the world. If you're going to go to India and look at community, even at the subnational level, mm-hmm. there's going to be a different set of reasons, economy, things that drive decisions there. So what's a frame for you? What's a helpful frame?
One of the frames is to think as much about the process or processes of developing good policy as you do about thinking that there's a single or a right set of policies, right? So on climate change, it is an absolutely critical issue and it's getting more critical by the day. But that doesn't mean actually that it is either morally or strategically more important than violence prevention, than poverty alleviation, than democratic legitimacy, than people feeling like they are empowered to make decisions about your community. So when those of us in places like Washington or American or European universities are trying to figure out climate change and energy questions, the first thing to do is to remember that these contexts are different and to talk to people and to listen to people in different places. So that when you discover, for example, in one part of the world that the critical question is energy access, then you need a climate policy that actually delivers additional affordable energy access, not one that simply says, well, you, because of climate policy, we can't help you with energy access. A really common one across the fast growing parts of the developing world is air pollution. Urban air pollution is absolutely a nightmare in dozens of huge developing country cities. So rather than just finger wagging or talking only about climate, those tens of millions of people in those places, their critical health question, the environmental one, is that the air is really bad for them and it's even worse for their children. So if we want to think about what are the climate, how do we address climate policy, we have to say, how do we address climate policy that actually delivers goods for everybody in a particular area, right? It delivers better, it delivers higher quality clean air at still at affordable price.
That's a lot of listening. It's a lot of listening. Yeah. And I think you're right too. It hits the next issue that interests, I think, all of us too, is how do you translate space to listen in policy?
Mm-hmm.
How do you make sure you don't have a rigidity built right. into a funding cycle or a process that's a little bit more friendly to, this project, best intentions, we need to pivot.
Yeah, right.
To another set of maybe another set of tools that are going to help the community get to the benefits stated. Yeah. For you, do you think there's ways that we can improve this process?
That's a good question. I think a couple of things. In terms of institutions, whether it's the World Bank or American Development Assistance or trade policy, you have to pause and ask yourselves if what you're engaging in is making the climate change problem worse, if it's making conflict of whatever kind, social or violent or gendered conflict, is it making it more likely? Could the policy you're using be, exacerbate some of these other problems? So I think when you're talking about big government institutions, one of the things you do is you build in reflective mechanisms, right? So I think that is important. I think the other thing is to try to resist the urge to imagine that policy is like a small basket of tools that, because they work for me, you should definitely use the same one that for you, right? But rather to think in terms of outcomes. So if outcomes are, yes, we need carbon emissions to go down. Yes, we need communities to be more resilient and adapt to the changing climate. But we also want them to be fairer. They want them to be more democratic. We want people to have economic opportunities. So if we think, I think, more in terms of what are these sets of goals that if we do them wrong, they will be in conflict. And if we do them right, some of them are win-win. It's not an ideal world, right? It's not that there still aren't hard trade-offs to make. There certainly are. There's still going to be controversies. There might still be, protests and those sorts of things. Anyone who's ever been to a local town meeting or any stakeholder process whatsoever knows that that's not a euphemism for consensus and utopia, right? It's just you're trying to get information and perspectives in so that what you do design is better than you might have designed it sitting in a room in a basement in Washington or a university office someplace where you, can get an inflated sense of having the right answer.
Have you been a part of kind of witnessing something that worked?
I think one of the places to look are more local level. Sometimes the idea of climate change makes our minds go right to big global meetings with people in suits and closed doors and protesters outside, all kind of global scale stuff, right? And even in those global scale forums, there are ways to make sure that people whose voices are often marginalized there you know, if there are indigenous people there and they're running their workshops and they're running their forums and they're saying why it is that they want some things and not others, then that's a listening forum. But also, but at local scale, right? When you're trying to figure out how to help a community that's either near the sea or in a river basin, how to help them deal with flood risks or sea level rise. Rather than coming in and saying, we're the experts, we know which ones of you are in the way, and we have a plan for you. You know, we have colleagues in Boston, and there are folks who are doing similar things here in the DC area, where you start a community conversation and say, look, we, you know, as the expert or the policymaker, you sometimes are bringing risk information that says, look, we're really worried that these are things that are not only are they possible, they're becoming more and more likely. These sorts of flood events are probably going to happen. So let's work together to figure out how in this community we want to deal with that. Do we want in this community to figure out how to use park land and open space as a kind of water buffer? Or do we in this community need instead to think about which parts can we protect and which parts do we have to leave for various kinds of buffers? You know, you can go on and on with this sort of thing. The outcome of such a process, right, it shouldn't just be better climate policy. It should also be, hopefully, that in any kind of process like that, you end up helping a few more people be more engaged in the future of their community than they were before. Because if their views and their preferences have mattered, that creates more of an environment in which they want to continue to articulate that.
I want to go over the work in terms of the region you're looking at, the Petrel States, and why backdraft is an important part of looking at this.
Right. Yeah. So I think one of the reasons that sort of initially drew me to the kind of looking at some of these petro states is that a whole lot of money flows from the U.S. and Europe and other, you know, and sort of global cities where wealthier people live. Lots of money flows to Nigeria, it flows to Chad, it flows to Russia, it flows to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, right? And some of these, many of these states, not all, but many of them have very poor governance, a lot of corruption, oil, a lot of environmental hazards from the oil industry, and people in those places have been really not been allowed to have democratic articulation. They can't, you know, they can't get control of the negatives in the oil company. And at the end of the day, that's much of our money, right? I mean, you know, that money is flowing from some countries to others. So we have some sort of shared responsibility for these very undemocratic and corrupt outcomes. And then when you look forward and think, okay, now we're engaged in this huge climate change conversation. And now if this climate change policy works, that money is going to stop flowing to you. So you don't have robust governance institutions. The state doesn't work very well. People are very alienated from it because it's corrupt. And now we're going to stop cutting the check, right? And it seems to me that that is a recipe for a lot of bad things, right? If the state becomes even less capable to deliver basic goods and people don't have faith in it and they don't know how to participate in it and it does not want their participation, and then over a relatively short amount of time, the money dries up, that's really a recipe for violence and migration. And I think we have to understand about oil-rich places that the challenges they have are not independent from our behaviors every day. Like, we bear some responsibility for the institutions and the mess that's there now. And to simply say, well, it's not our problem if, you know, we stop sending money to you and things get a whole lot worse.
So what's the realistic way to address the stuff that we can control?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think one of the realistic ways is to talk openly about the fact that climate and energy policies are changing and that this sort of these oil economies, this is going to happen, right? This is probably going to happen. So that I think one thing is to make our government talk openly about it and not pretend that it isn't happening. but also to kind of demand that some of the leaders think about this. So, for example, Saudi Arabia is no more democratic now than it used to be, but it actually is both in its government and in its large state oil company, it's grappling with what to do after it's not, after the oil is no longer the ticket to constant wealth, right? So it's working to diversify. It's got study groups. It's got its universities trying to grapple with this. You know, it's a new effort. I don't know how successful it's going to be, but it's certainly the case that a whole bunch of other petrostates are watching Saudi Arabia, because if they're doing this, it's important to look at. Similarly, we have our neighbors both to the north and to the south, and parts of the American West and the Gulf Coast. While our country is not overly economically dependent on the oil money, it is dependent on the oil, but we got communities all over America and in Canada and in Mexico where if we move to an economy that uses less oil, these communities, just like the coal communities in West Virginia and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Illinois, you know, if we haven't thought about what happens to people in these places when the economy changes, we have not done them a service of good government and we haven't been good citizens. And look, plenty of things happen in the world that are very hard to anticipate. But when you know we're going to be using less coal, which we clearly are, and when you know that if climate and energy policy is successful, we should be using less oil a few years from now than we are now, that means we have to think about those implications. We can't just say that it's very nice sounding, you know, it's very nice sounding to say, well, you know, the new energy economy will take up all these jobs and these sorts of things we often hear at election time. That's true, but only as far as it goes. Yes, there are millions of jobs in the new energy economy, but they may not be in the same states. They are not in the same communities. They may not be for people with the same skills. And so kind of pretending that just because we add 100,000 jobs over here and subtract them over here, that those 100,000 lost jobs, that those communities are taken care of, that will not work, right? So that, I think, is why we have to anticipate we have to anticipate this transition, and we have to anticipate the hard bits as well as the exciting parts.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.